Welcome, and thank you for joining us for today's IBM teleconference, IMS Security in the Post-SMU Era, How You Can Benefit from RACF. Today's teleconference will be recorded, will last approximately 60 minutes, and will include a live question and answer session. After attending this teleconference, you'll come away with a good understanding of how to develop a rock-solid security strategy for IMS systems. The speaker for today's teleconference is Alan Cooper, IMS Specialist, IBM Europe. At this time, I would like to hand it over to our speaker, Alan Cooper.
Thank you very much, and hello, everybody. On the cover slide, I've chosen a slightly shorter title, IMS Rock Solid Security in the Post-SMU Era. It still sounds like the title of a composition by Shostakovich, or maybe the title of a PhD thesis. In fact, I'm simply going to talk about the range of IMS security facilities that are available, and in particular, about achieving completely rock-solid security of a security product such as RACF. I'll be mentioning several specific RACF facilities, but I assume that similar facilities are available in other security products. And in general, I'm going to talk about what you can do and not about the implementation details of how you do it. So, turning to slide 2, this is IBM's standard disclaimer. I believe everything I say will be true, but we can all make mistakes. So, moving on to slide 3, the need for rock-solid security in IMS. Once upon a time, IMS security used to be fairly easy to set up. You had a predefined set of L terms, and these were the basis of your smooth security. These days, of course, we've moved on to user ID-based security with RACF or an equivalent product. There are potentially very many defined users, and in some cases, we need to provide access for unknown users. Coupled with this, there is now a variety of ways for users to gain access to IMS, via traditional SNA terminals, via ATPC, or via OTMA. There is a heightened awareness of security threats, be it from outside or inside the enterprise, and there's a corresponding emphasis on security auditing. So what it all boils down to is the need for demonstrable rock-solid security in IMS. So, turning then to slide 4, this is my agenda. I'll begin by briefly overviewing some general facilities that you get when using RACF with IMS. Then we'll look at the essential aspects of providing rock-solid security, covering dataset security, TM security, and DBRC security. Then I'll complete the session with a quick look at some other end-user security aspects and security auditing. So, skipping over my section header, let's go to slide 6. To look at some general aspects of using IMS with RACF. RACF can be used to protect access to many types of IMS resource, including the IMS systems themselves, common service layer address spaces in an IMS Plex, OTMA client connections within the OTMA XCS group, shared queue structures, system and database datasets, transactions, commands entered at terminals or spots. It can control access to PSBs used by BMPs, ODBA, or CPIC applications, and it can protect DBRC commands and data in the RECON dataset. And we'll see much more details as we move through the presentation. So, let's go on to slide 7. RACF security is based on authorizing user IDs to access defined resources. And for IMS security, there are several types of user ID. Firstly, there are the user IDs of real people. Then, you might have user IDs specified by some middleware components, which pretend to be real end users as far as IMS is concerned. Thirdly, IMS address spaces also typically have user IDs, be they IMS system address spaces or IMS-dependent regions. And finally, you can define convenience user IDs, where the user ID is the same as a transaction code, a command word, an L-term name, an MSC MS name or a PSC name. Now, for the IMS control region user ID, it's sometimes used for security checking because no other user ID is available. Personally, using such a generic ID does not match my concept of rock-solid, tightly audited security. And so, where this applies, I'll be indicating alternatives at various points throughout this presentation. Turning to slide 8. Almost all aspects of IMS security can be implemented with either or both of RACF and an IMS user exit. And my objective is to provide full security with just RACF wherever possible. So I'm only going to mention a security exit when it's the only way to achieve a clear additional benefit. Slide 9. How IMS uses RACF. This is just to give an indication of the ways that IMS uses RACF. It's not a list of all the actual RACF calls, of course. At IMS startup, IMS issues a RACroot list call that global equals yes to build in a data space a complete set of resource profiles for all the transactions, commands, and so on associated with that IMS system. Also at startup, IMS issues RACroot verifies for its address space user IDs to get the address space ACEEs built. An ACEE is the RACF control block that represents a user ID, and we'll be mentioning it several times as we go through. As users sign on, or first send in messages via OTMA, RACroot verifies are issued to build their ACEEs. And whenever a security check is required, IMS issues a RACroot fast-auth call, which exploits a pre-built ACEE and the appropriate resource profile from the data space. So that's basically all I want to say in this very brief overview of RACF facilities for IMS. So skipping over my next section header, let's move on to look at the details, starting with IMS dataset security on slide 11. When RACF first appeared back in 1976, its job was to provide dataset security, a role that it still performs today. And if Confucius were alive today, he would tell us that without IMS dataset security, you don't have IMS security. So all IMS system and database datasets must be secured. And don't forget the catalogs as well. There's more detail on the next slide, slide 12. Whoever has a dataset DD card needs the RACF access authority. So IMS system address spaces will need to have RACF user IDs. These days, RACF has a resource class with the name started. Here you can identify started tasks to RACF without having to re-ITL, and so this is the recommended way if you are needing to register IMS started tasks. The IMS region user IDs should be defined to RACF with the protected attribute. This is what you get when you specify no password, no OID card, and no phrase. Doing this ensures that no mischievous user can log on to TSO, for example, using an IMS region ID as his user ID. So, returning to IMS datasets, you obviously need to set up the permissions in RACF for the IMS system address spaces, for batch and utility users, and for appropriate systems personnel to access the various IMS datasets. Okay, so let's move to the next section now on IMS Transaction Manager security. Skipping over the section header, moving on to slide 14. IMS security-related parameters. You can specify a security macro in your IMS system definition. And this, in fact, consolidates security information from the COM and the IMS Gen macros. And personally, I would recommend removing any security parameters you have on the COM and IMS Gen macros for the benefit of your colleagues or successors who might be unfamiliar with IMS's definitional flexibility. Potentially on the security macro, you can have four parameters. Only one, seccnt, sec count, is actually unique to the IMS system definition. The other three can be specified in execution parameters and which then take precedence. R-class on the security macro or in your DFS-DC member identifies the names of the IMS resource classes in RACF for that IMS system. So if you put R-class equals IMP4, the IMS classes will be T-IMP4, D-IMP4, C-IMP4, and so on. RACF comes with default classes for IMS, T-IMS, D-IMS, C-IMS, and so on, which you can use if you have just a single IMS or a single IMS plex that requires security. Otherwise, it's best to have a different R-class for each system or IMS plex. Again, things have changed since the days when I first looked at RACF, and you can now easily and dynamically add new RACF classes to the dynamic class descriptor table. I'll return to the second parameter, sec count, at the very end of the presentation. So turning on to slide 15, the sec level and type parameters can be specified on the security macro or in your DFS-PB member. My personal choice would be to either omit these from the security macro or ensure that they match the DFS-PB values. Sec level is used to indicate that some form of security is required if a user signs on and or for transaction authorization. It doesn't actually force sign-on to happen and doesn't care whether you use RACF, an exit, or both. It also indicates if the values are forced or whether the operator can override them at IMS restart time. The other parameter, the type parameter, provides a more specific list of the security requirements. But since the DFS-PB parameters allow even more options to be specified, my inclination is to omit the type parameter and just use DFS-PB, RCF, and ISIS execution parameters. So for rock-solid security, I would choose, as shown in the middle of the slide, forced sign-on and forced transaction security, and I'd set RCF equals A, get universal RACF sign-on transaction and command security. Additionally, I'd probably choose ISIS equals R to activate RACF resource access security, or RAS, and we'll be looking at each of these types of security shortly. So, moving on, slide 16. This mentions the other IMS execution parameters that relate to security. Those flagged with an asterisk or in the darker colour will be mentioned in this presentation, but because of time constraints, investigation of the other parameters is left as an exercise for yourselves. So, moving quickly on to slide 17. We've seen that you can specify, on the security macro for example, that a security check is to take place if a user signs on. But on this slide, we're discussing forcing. Now, ETO end user terminals have no choice. They must sign on. But for static end user terminals, those defined in the IMS Gen with terminal macros, you can specify that none, some, or all of them require sign on. This is explained in the lower half of the slide, but which I'm not going to discuss right now. Later, we'll look at the security options available when the user is not forced to and does not sign on. But for now, let's turn to slide 18, IMS region IDs. Earlier, I said that IMS system address spaces should have user IDs assigned, and this was for dataset security purposes, but the control region ID is also potentially used for other purposes that we'll see shortly. Your dependent regions should also have user IDs assigned, but please use different user IDs from the system address space IDs. Dependent region IDs are used especially with resource access security, or RAS, and we'll talk more about this later. Like the system address space user ID, the dependent region user IDs should be defined to RECF with the protected attribute so that they can't be used for end-user logon. For the tightest control on security, both the system and the dependent region address space IDs should also have the restricted attribute specified. Should such a restricted user ID be used to input a transaction or command, access will only be granted if the IMS resource has been explicitly permitted for use by that address space user ID. Permissions for generic user IDs or universal access will be ignored. Okay, let's go on to slide 19. IMS connection security. This has two aspects. Firstly, security when external clients attempt to connect to IMS. And in particular on this slide, I'm just thinking of SNA terminals signing on. The second aspect is when dependent regions start up and try to connect to the control region. A prerequisite for this is that resource access security be enabled, and we'll see more about that later. IMS system IDs must be R-defined in the RACF APL class, APPL class. Then, the end-user user IDs who are to be allowed to sign on must be permitted in RACF to access the relevant IMS systems in the APL class. Dependent region connection security is similar, except that it's the region user IDs that must be permitted to access the relevant IMS systems. And in this case, the region IDs will include all the BMP user IDs as well as MPP and ISP region IDs. And let's say we'll return to this later. So moving on, slide 20. For SNA terminals, there is another check that can take place at sign-on time. Namely, is this user permitted to use the physical terminal? The terminals, ETEM nodes, LUs, or whatever you call them, are defined in the terminal RACF class or grouped in the G terminal class. And as an optional extra, you can even limit a user's terminal access to certain days of the week and or times of the day. Again, I stress that for connection security on the previous slide and for terminal security on this slide, the authorization checks are performed at sign-on time and not when you log on to IMS. So if a terminal is not forced to and does not sign on, then these two types of security will not apply. Turning on to slide 21, security with IMS Connect is equally secure. An IMS Connect address space should have a user ID with the protected and restricted attributes, please, and can have connection security invoked at client bid time. It requires the OTMA security level for that IMS Connect to be checked or full. Each message coming from IMS Connect into IMS will have an associated user ID that was either specified by IMS Connect's client or else was a default user ID added by IMS Connect itself. And IMS OTMA will build the user's ACEE and cache it until the aging value expires. And with IMS 10, different OTMA clients, such as IMS Connect, can specify their own aging value at client bid time. When IMS Connect is set up to implement security and receives from its remote client an input containing a user ID, it will typically call RACF to validate the user ID and password. Alternatively, and even more secure, a remote client can itself validate the user ID, build a pass ticket, and send that in instead of a password. So, IMS Connect will supply a user ID on each input to IMS OTMA. OTMA will build an ACEE the first time it encounters a new user ID, and this will be used for subsequent transaction and command authorizations, just like for a signed-on SNA terminal user. And this leads me nicely on to slide 22, transaction security. I'm not sure there's much I need to say about this. I'm assuming that the basic concepts of transaction classes and transaction group classes are understood. But I will say this. As always in RACS, it is very important to define a catch-all generic transaction with name asterisk asterisk and which has a universal access of none. This ensures, for example, that if any new transactions get added to the system in the future, perhaps with dynamic resource definitions, then they will not be usable until appropriate permits have been set up in RACS. And as a belt and braces approach, you can also specify that the transaction class, for example, TIMS, has a default return code of 8. This means that if a transaction is not defined to RACS, an authorization is requested, rather than respond with the default resource not known, RACS will simply respond with deny access. Also note, there's a difference between giving a transaction universal access and permitting ID asterisk to access the transaction. Specifying ID asterisk will only allow access by registered user IDs. Note what I said earlier, both these ways of providing general access exclude access by user IDs which have the restricted attribute. Turning on to slide 23, some customers have even more stringent security requirements and demand that certain special transactions are only usable in certain rooms, for example, certain buildings. The usual approach to this is to use a combination of RACS and the Transaction Authorization User Exit, CFS-CTRN0. But some customers these days are reluctant to write exits in assembler code, so an alternative approach is to additionally exploit SNA terminal security. For example, you could issue an extra user ID to each user who's authorized to use the special transactions. So each special user would have two user IDs. They would use their alternative user ID to sign on when they were in the special building or the special room, and terminal security would enforce that the special user ID could not sign on from anywhere else. These special user IDs would then be the only ones authorized to access the restricted transactions. So that's just a suggestion. Okay, moving on to slide 24. What if there is no user ID? Transactions coming in via OTMA or from ETO terminals or from signed-on static terminals will contain a user ID. And incidentally, if appropriate for SNA terminals, by using the ETO logon exit, you can cause sign-on to be done automatically at logon time and so avoid the need for the end user to actually have to enter any sign-on data. This works for ETO and static terminals, but it does require ETO to be enabled. Now, as we saw earlier, you can choose to set up your system with static terminals that do not require sign-on. If you do this, then take care. If the user does not sign on, then there will be no connection and no terminal security, and there will be no end-user ACEE built. So in this case, transaction and command security will use the control region user ID. As I hinted earlier, I find it hard to reconcile tight, well-audited security with the use of generic user IDs such as the control region ID. So a better solution would be if IMS would automatically sign on specified static terminals, perhaps using the LTERM name as the user ID. And this is a well-understood requirement, and you can look at the OpenAPAR PK85571 for a resolution. Auto-sign function. Turning on, slide 25. When a transaction issues a change call for a transaction destination or an auth call for a transaction resource, RACS is again called to check that the user is allowed to access this new transaction. In some environments, notably shared queues and MSC, the executing transaction might be on a different IMS system from the one that performed the original transaction authorization. In this case, IMS will require the user's ACEE to be dynamically built on this back-end system, and this will happen automatically. For APPC and OTMA input, you can influence performance in APPC SE and OTMA SE execution parameters. For non-APPC and non-OTMA input, you can use the DFSB SEX0 exit to eliminate the RACS check, for example, if you are certain it will not compromise security. I just mentioned MSC a moment ago, so this leads me on to the next slide, slide 26. With MSC, transaction security takes place as normal on the front end, but if the transaction is routed to a different system, an additional security check can take place on the receiving system. You'll need to make careful consideration of whether or not a security check is needed at this time. You use the MSC SEC execution parameter to control this. And if you do choose to perform the security check, you can additionally control which user ID is used for the check. You can use the end user's user ID, but this will cause the ACEE to be dynamically created and deleted for each transaction. However, this might well be the right solution if you are using, say, the DFS MSCE0 exit on the receiving system to change the transaction code in the message. But otherwise, the best performance will be achieved using cached ACEEs, which are built just once, by choosing to use the MSC MS name as the user ID. Again, you'd need to set the MS names as convenient user IDs in RACS. There is another option. You can choose to use the receiving control region's user ID, but by now you know my feelings about that. Finally, you can dynamically choose whether or not to do the security check, and if so, what user ID to use, but this requires the use of the DFS MSCE0 exit. So, let's move on to command security, starting on slide 27. We'll start by considering commands entered as SNA terminals and MBS consoles. These are, by definition, type 1 commands. Again, I'm assuming that the basic concept of R defining command verbs, probably in groups, is well understood using the CIMS and the DIMS classes, or your equivalents. The key limitation with this implementation is that RACF will control access to just a command verb and does not differentiate between, for example, a /stop DB and a /stop node. To achieve a greater level of granularity, you have to either use the command authorization exit, DFSCCMD0, or else enter the command at a SPOC, and we'll consider that in just a moment. RACF is not called for commands entered at the MBS system console or the MTO terminal, but MCS and EMCS console do have associated user IDs and can be subject to standard RACF command security, but this must be requested for the IMS execution parameter CMD-MCS. Moving on to slide 28. If you have enabled the common service layer, as is strongly recommended these days, then you can enter commands via a SPOC to an operations manager. In this case, you can enter type 1 or the newer type 2 commands. All the CSL address spaces, including SPOCs, undergo a security check when they attempt to join the IMS Plex. So a TSO SPOC's user's user ID, for example, must be permitted to access the IMS Plex, which will be R-defined as a resource in the RACS facility class. For Type 2 commands, command security is always implemented by the operations manager. For Type 1 commands, the security check can be in either or in both of the operations manager and the target IMS control region. And the most obvious choice is to do all your command security in the operations manager, as this will be the most efficient technique, and it also offers greater granularity than the traditional command security that we saw on the previous slide. So Turning on to slide 29, commands for OM security are defined in the upper commands class, and you define a combination of the command verb and the primary keyword, and this is for both type 1 and type 2 commands. Of course, if you want security to be based on secondary keywords, then you'll still need to use an exit, and in this case, it is the OM command security exit defined in your BPE exit list. This would be necessary, for example, with type 2 commands to deny access to commands with name asterisk as the target resource, or to differentiate on the Q command between NQ and DQ options. So, moving on to slide 30, where I'll say just a few words about IMS's time control operations, or TCO. TCO scripts can issue transactions and type 1 commands. The scripts reside in the DFS TCS library, and a script called DFS TCS will be loaded automatically at IMS startup if it exists. You can dynamically change the current script by sending a specially formatted message to the L term DFS CTS. And security for controlling script changing is performed by the DFS TCNT0 user exit. And it's a rare case of where there is no RACF equivalent. But of course, you should set up very tight RACF security on the script library data set itself. The first command in a TCO script should be a slash sign-on command. The specified user ID will then be used for transaction security for any transactions entered by the script. But the IMS execution parameter TCO RACF equals Y must be set to enable RACF command security to take place for TCO entered commands. Oh, and by the way, don't forget to use the RACF command password to disable password expiration for the TCO user ID. You don't want to have to change the password every 90 days, or whatever. And also, it's probably best not to issue a sign-off in a TCO script, as TCO can set up actions to take place in the future after the script has actually been processed. This is not what it says in the manuals, or indeed in some of my earlier presentations. So don't use a sign-off. Moving on, slide 31. Command security with automated operator programs. IMS online programs can execute commands using either the CMD or the ICMD VO1 calls. RACF command security can be used with these commands. You can control what user ID is used for the RACF check. For a non-message driven BMP, it is the user ID from the job card. But for transactions, you can choose from three options on a transaction code by transaction code basis. Firstly, you can check the user's user ID against the command verb in the CIMS class or your equivalent. Or the second option is that you can check the tran code of the user ID against the command verb in CIMS. And the third option is you can check the command verb of the user ID against the tran code in TIMS, in the CIMS resource. My view is that either the second or third technique is the appropriate one to use. It's basically what we used to get with smooths. So you'd need to define the tran codes and or command verbs as user IDs to RACF. I call these convenience user IDs, and they too should be set up with the protected and restricted attributes. So let's go on to the next slide, slide 32. Resource Access Security, or RAS, replaces what used to be called AGN security and might better be called dependent region security. It turns on with the ISIS execution parameter or the security system definition macro. When RAS is enabled, the check is performed at every program schedule, be it a BMP or IFP starting up or a message processing program being dynamically scheduled. It checks if the region user ID is authorized to use an application resource, a PFP or a tran code is appropriate. And there are more details on the slide. This check is particularly important for BMPs, which can potentially be submitted by anybody in a large group of TSO users, for example. When RAS is enabled, you can additionally get dependent region connection security, as we discussed earlier, if the IMS systems are defined in the RACF Apple class. And again, this is especially important for BMPs. RACF will check if the BMP's jobs user ID is authorized to access this IMS system. Again, I emphasize that this requires that both RAS and Apple security be enabled. So that completes my section on TN security. Skipping over the next page, let's go on to slide 34, where I'll say a few words about BBRC security. The RECON datasets hold data that is essential for database and system recovery, and so should be managed with a high degree of security. Before IMS 10, everyone allowed to use the RECONs had to be given a RACF access level of control. And this exposes the RECONs to malicious access via non-IMS programs. Now, in principle, you can use RACF to give conditional access to datasets by specifying not just who can access the dataset, but with which programs. But I suspect it would typically be very difficult to administer this degree of control. However, IMS 10 provides significant relief, and you can grant just read access to the majority of users, those who simply need to issue list commands. People allowed to enter update commands should be granted update access, and similarly, the user IDs of the control region, the online DBRC address space, and all standalone DLI batch utilities and tool jobs should also be granted update access. In addition to DBRC, you can control the use of the different DBRC commands. And this is covered on the next page, slide 35. DBRC command security has excellent granularity. The facility class is used for defining combinations of command verb, resource type, and resource name. So, in the example towards the bottom of the slide, you can see a resource for the IMP4 system, which is a genjco.recuv command for the database LedgerDB. As you can see, I've been granted permission to issue this command. Incidentally, as shown at the top of the slide, this security applies to commands entered by the DBRC utility, the HowDB partition definition utility, online IMS/RMX commands, and programs using the DBRC API. Okay, I'm approaching the end now, but I've got a few additional points I'd like to make. So turning on to slide 37, I've included here a couple of slides on various aspects of end-user security. Firstly, in client-server situations, if the remote client can generate a pass ticket and send that in place of a password, it does provide for more secure communications and is fully supported by IMS Connect, IMS, and of course, RACF. Using mixed-case passwords is inherently more secure than using just uppercase passwords. IMS 10 and IMS Connect 10 both support mixed-case passwords. And note that, at least from the IMS perspective, switching on mixed-case password support is not a problem for end users. Only after a user actually next changes his password does RACF start to check that the proper case is used. And moving on again to slide 38, where end users are using ETO terminals in high security environments, you should be exploiting the automatic sign-off time or ASOC facility. This will ensure that if the terminal is left unused for more than the specified number of minutes, then that user will automatically get signed off. And if you need to be absolutely certain that the user on the terminal is the same one who actually signed on, and you can define selected transactions or commands to RACF with a special IMS option, the re-verify option. And this also requires the IMS execution parameter RVFY equals yes. So for these appropriate transactions and commands, the user must re-enter his or her personal password with the input data, presumably using an MFS non-display field. MFS will then insert the password into the input message in brackets after the transcode or command verb, just as it did with the old SMU password support. Now, for just a brief look at security auditing, skip over the next page and go to slide 40. IMS always requests RACF auditing of its RACF calls. RACF uses SMS to externalize its audit trail. But additionally, of course, IMS itself logs key security information for sign-ons and sign-offs and security violations. Also, it stores the relevant user ID in log records of messages and database updates, assuming, of course, that the user has supplied the user ID. Security violations can also cause an immediate alert to be raised, and there are three ways of doing this. Firstly, RACF can send a message to its security console. Secondly, when you define resources such as transactions to RACF, you can specify a TSO user ID to be notified if an associated security violation occurs. And finally, on the IMS security system definition macro, you can use the seccnt parameter, the seccount parameter, to indicate that the MTO is to receive notifications of security violations. So this should be sufficient to keep the auditors happy. Moving on to slide 42, IMS RACF security is a big subject, and there are several aspects that we have not covered today. I've listed on this slide the areas that came to my mind, but hopefully I've covered the main topics that need to be considered when endeavouring to provide very high security with IMS. So just to summarise, over the page, on page 43, RACF offers a wide range of facilities relevant to securing your IMS system, but as always, it's up to you to choose the facilities relevant to your needs. Some IMS RACF facilities are obvious choices and form the basis of your security setup. I'm thinking of data set access security, sign-on security, transaction security, command security, and probably RAS security. Other IMS RACF facilities can provide even tighter security. For example, terminal security, connection security, DBRC command security, and so on. RACF also offers various general facilities for further enhancing your security, protected and restricted attributes, catch-all generic profiles, mixed-case passwords, and so on and so forth. And IMS too offers choices, whether or not to force sign-on to static terminals, how to do AOI security or MSC link receive security. Do you want more granular control with security exits? And so on. But the bottom line is, if you make the appropriate choices, you can get absolutely rock-solid, tightly controlled, well-audited IMS security. Thank you. And now I'll hand back to the operator.
Thank you, Alan. Now we would like to ask you to participate in a brief electronic survey. Right after the survey, we will have a live question and answer session with the presenter. Your feedback is important to us, and we do appreciate the time you take to answer these questions. To participate, simply press the star key followed by the number that best corresponds to your choice. Please listen to all options before making your selection. Question 1. Please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star 1. If it was medium, press star 2. And if it was low, press star 3. You may vote now. Again, please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star 1. If it was low, press medium, press star 2. And if it was low, press star 3. Please vote now. Question two, was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference, if it was at the right level, press star one. If it was not technical enough, press star two. If it was more technical than I needed to hear, press star three. You may vote now. Again, was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference, if it was at the right level, press star one. If it was not technical enough, press star two. If it was more technical than I needed to hear, press star three. Please vote now. One moment, please. Question 3. What version of IMS are you currently on? If version 10, press star 1. If version 9, press star 2. If version 8, press star 3. If version 7 and below, press star 4. You may vote now. Again, what version of IMS are you currently on? If version 10, press star 1. If version 9, press star 2. If version 8, press star 3. And if version 7 and below, press star 4. Please vote now. Question 4. For those not on IMS 10, what is your planned use of IMS 10? If you plan to install IMS 10 within the next 6 to 12 months, press star 1. If you are interested in moving to IMS 10 within the next 2 years, press star 2. If you are not interested in IMS 10 at this time, press star 3. You may vote now. Again, for those not on IMS 10, what is your planned use of IMS 10? If you plan to install IMS 10 in the next 6 to 12 months, press star 1. If you are interested in moving to IMS 10 within the next 2 years, press star 2. If you are not interested in IMS 10 at this time, press star 3. Please vote now. And question 5. We hope you have enjoyed today's teleconference. Please let us know if you are interested in receiving additional information or follow-up regarding the products discussed today. If yes, press star 1. If no, press star 2. You may vote now. Again, we hope you have enjoyed the teleconference today. Please let us know if you are interested in receiving additional information or follow-up regarding the products discussed today. If yes, press star 1. If no, press star 2. Please vote now. And that concludes our survey. Thank you all for your participation. Now let's move to your questions. To ask your question, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone at any time. And to withdraw your request, you may press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1, unmute your line, and record your name at this time. And at this time, I will turn the call back over to our speaker while we wait for questions.
Yep.
And at this time, I'm showing that we have no questions, so I will turn the call back to you, sir, for closing comments.
Okay. Well, first of all, know that my email address is on the front page, so if there are any questions that come up, please feel free to send them to me. And let me just say thank you again for joining me today. I hope we've given you some new ideas. IMS security is a very big subject, but it does offer everything you need to fully satisfy whatever levels of security you require. So thanks again.